Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within and beyond the West End. Today's episode is about an infamous day in Soho's history, when one of its most feared gangsters got his comeuppance, having been gunned down in a dingy basement. He was so hated and despised that his death was covered up to protect his attacker. But who was Amabile Rika, and what was the truth? Murder Mile is researched using the original police files. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds. So that, no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 94, The Terror of Maltese London. Today, I'm standing on Carlisle Street in Soho, W1. One road east of the Blackout Ripper's second victim, Evelyn Oatley. One street north of the mafia hit on Alfredo Zamparelli. Three roads south of the Charlotte Street robbery. A few doors up from the chronic Canadian masturbator, Richard Rhodes Henley. And just a few streets from the home of the final victim of one of Britain's most terrifying serial killers. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Carlisle Street sits at the top of Dean Street. It's a tiny side street, barely 100 feet long, with a dead end to the left, Soho Square to the right, Old Compton Street below, and the Tottenham Court Road exit of the Elizabeth Line above. Even though it's nowhere near Tottenham Court Road, and is actually on Oxford Street. But hey, don't planners just love confusing the tourists? This street has all the essentials that any aspiring Soho resident would ever need. There's a jazz club, a piano bar, two pubs, a secret gin joint, a posh hotel for the rich, a posh hostel for the not-so-poor, and loads of Airbnbs for those who aren't choosy about sleeping in a part-time brothel, as well as two pizza shops, a hairdresser's, a nail salon, a lap dancing club, a centre for drug addicts, a sexual disease clinic, and the headquarters of satirical newspaper, Private Eye. Oh yes, all of the essentials. Next to Pizza Pilgrims is number 3 Carlisle Street. A 4-story brown brick premises with an anonymous black door, which is now the offices for a developer of boutique hotels. Oh joy. So expect another swanky pad to be built real soon, with pillows woven from yak scrotums, bedsheets washed in Perrier, loo paper folded into the shape of the guest's name, stunningly beautiful meals that can only be eaten using tweezers, a minibar with 52 varieties of tap water, and an entirely unironic gallery featuring photos of the old Soho that they bulldozed to make way for this fake Soho. And yet, it was here, on Thursday the 15th of June 1948, in the basement of No. 3 Carlisle Street, that one of Soho's deadliest and most feared gangsters, called Amabal Rika, was erased forever. Amabal Rika was known by everyone as the terror of Maltese London. The whole of Soho and beyond knew about this monster. He was part man, part myth, but pure evil. A nasty, brutal bully with crazy eyes, fast fists, and a furious temper. And as this crazed killer stalked the shadows, curtains closed, doors shut, and streets fell silent, as every man, boy, and gangster trembled and quaked, as they lived in fear of the terror of Maltese London. In court, petrified witnesses muttered their descriptions of him as,
"He's a monster, a real monster.
He truly is a very dangerous man. No one could touch him. Not the police, not the bosses, no one."
And although it is said that many witnesses were too scared and intimidated to testify against him at trial, everyone agreed,
"We're all frightened of him. He's killed before, and he'll kill again."
And always being armed with a knife, a gun, and a knuckle duster, as Soho's most feared gangster who would hurt any rival with impunity, word got around that
he is the most dangerous Maltese man in the country.
Why haven't you heard of this beast? Because no one in all of Soho and beyond dared to speak the name of the terror of Maltese London. Or so they say. You see, the problem with gangsters is there's often a large discrepancy between the man and the myth, as the bulk of a gangster's work is to build their reputation. Fear is a greater weapon than a gun, so it's simpler to have a rival back down than to risk a fight to the death. Every gangster claims to be the biggest, the baddest, and the cruelest. And when you live in a world of lies, reputations are created with rarely an ounce of truth or proof, except by the pals of wannabe gangsters, as just by knowing them, they also benefit by making a myth. In 1910, Amabal Rika was born in Valletta, the capital city of Malta, a tiny island in the Mediterranean Sea between Italy, Libya, and Tunisia. Little is known about his upbringing, except the basics. His father died young. He was one of six siblings. Aged 13, he was sent to Borstal for theft. He left school uneducated. He had no known occupation. He married aged 19 and fathered four children. In fact, the only accurate details we have about his life are from his criminal record. On paper, there's no denying that Amabal Rika was a criminal, having amassed 47 convictions by the age of 28. And part of his terrifying reputation was built on the fact that he'd served prison time for GBH, attempted murder, and murder. In truth, he was little more than a mindless thug, who was hot-tempered, fond of his drink, and handy with his fists. So although his number of convictions was impressive, the crimes themselves were not. His 47 convictions included 27 counts of fighting while drunk, 8 counts of assault while drunk, 2 counts of willful damage while drunk, 5 counts of insulting a policeman, 3 counts of uttering immoral words in public, 1 count of trespassing, and another count of being a stowaway on a ship, meaning he didn't buy a ticket.
Ooh, what a bad boy.
He was imprisoned twice, fined often, and all of his heinous crimes were marked on his record as minor offences. His reputation as a big-time gangster was built on the foundation of being a small-time crook. But a big part of his myth-making was that he had murdered a man in Malta.
We're all frightened of him. He's killed before, and he'll kill again.
The most dangerous Maltese man in the country.
But the truth of what happened isn't exactly the kind of myth which makes a monster. On the 17th of May 1932, 22-year-old Amabile was tried at Malta Court. The jury heard that whilst he and his pal were fooling around with a loaded revolver, it slipped from his fingers, bounced, misfired, and having been shot in the leg, his pal died a day later of blood loss and shock. Amabile wasn't charged with murder, manslaughter, or even GBH. He was found guilty of the minor offence of causing death through negligence and non-observance of the regulations. He served 4 months in prison. Amabile wasn't a killer. He was an imbecile. But having fudged the facts, a legitimate lie had become a terrifying tale for those with no access to the truth. In 1938, Amabile fled Malta with his wife and eldest son. He served briefly in the army, separated from his wife, shacked up with a gypsy woman in Kent called Louisa, and had 4 more children. By wartime, with the rise of Maltese gangsters like the Messina brothers and the Vassallo gang, even though he went by such preposterous nicknames as the Maltese Barber and Ricky the Malt, simply by being Maltese meant that his name came with a cachet of fear.
He's a monster, a real monster.
Backed up by a myth that he was a killer.
He's killed before and he'll kill again.
In 1947, he was convicted twice, serving 3 months for stealing food stamps and 18 months for assault, which he bragged was attempted murder, but it wasn't.
We're all frightened of him.
And this is how his myth grew.
No one could touch him. Not the police, not the bosses, no one.
On the 13th of June 1948, the 38-year-old boasted that he had roughed up a rival in a brawl on Bateman Street. But it was little more than a slight scuffle with a barrow boy, which left him with a limp.
He is the most dangerous Maltese man in the country.
But as people gossip and word spread, what began as a small fib soon spawned into something truly terrifying. And that is how Amabile Rica became the terror of Maltese London. And yet, having got into a petty beef with a couple of minor hoods, 2 days later, he was dead. Amabile Rica's reign of terror was extinguished by the Ferrugia brothers. Unlike their rival, who was only one, they were 3. Philip, Francis, and Joseph Ferrugia. And just like the terror of Maltese London, their reputations as villains, hoods, and bad boys, who were feared, respected, and bladdy bladdy blah, is still a lie which is trotted out in those tawdry, semi-literate toilet paper books, usually titled
Geezers and Gangsters,
which over-glorify the criminal acts of massive morons to a mythical status, without a single shred of proof. So in fact, the truth about the Ferrugia brothers is less terrifying and rather more Pathetic. Born 7 years apart, with Philip in 1912, Joseph in 1919, and Francis in 1926, the Farrugia brothers were raised in the Maltese city of Zeebrugge to a farmer mother and a stonemason father. With Philip becoming a cook, Joseph working as a stevedore unloading cargo ships, and Francis as a labourer in Valletta Harbour. As with Amabile, the only facts we have about these big-time villains is from their criminal records. Joseph Farrugia, commonly known by the nickname of Joe, or when his mummy was angry with him, by his birth name of Giuseppe. He had two convictions for brawling, one for disturbing the peace, one for using immoral words, one for throwing stones, and one which he could have used to balloon his bad boy image by fudging the facts to suggest that it was attempted murder. But having accidentally discharged a gun near his father and causing a very superficial wound, it was deemed such a minor misdemeanor that he was given a slap on the wrist and sent home. Joseph was bound over twice, he served no prison time, and he paid fines that totaled a whopping 12 shillings. He came to London in April 1946, leaving his wife and two children in Malta. He shacked up with a sex worker called Cecily Courtney. He served 4 months for living off immoral earnings, as being broke, he lived in her Notting Hill flat. And he worked as a waiter at the Premier restaurant on Oxford Street. As for his older brothers, Francis, nicknamed Frank, but born Francisco, was charged twice for fighting, once for using immoral words like damn, God, and maybe even bugger, and was fined 10 shillings. He moved to London in December 1946 and joined Joseph as a cook on Oxford Street. Whereas Philip, although he claimed to be a decent, hard-working man, with a wife, a child, and a successful career as head chef at the Melita restaurant, also on Oxford Street. In April 1948, he was found guilty of running a brothel and was fined £52, which he paid. And that is the infamous and terrifying Farrugia brothers. They're not exactly big-time criminals, but this need for a fearsome status does make sense, as living and working in post-war Soho, being Maltese men whose nationality came with a certain criminal cachet, it's less likely that their reputation was a true reflection of who they really were, and it's more likely that they adopted a persona to protect themselves from others, as fear is a greater weapon than a gun. So there you have it. Four of Soho's most infamous villains, comprised of little more than a mouthy ruffian who limped like a lame puppy, having bashed up his tootsies in a brawl with a barrow boy, and three part-time cooks with a brief history of fisticuffs, chucking stones, and uttering dirty words. Ooh. And yet, on Tuesday the 15th of June 1948, Joseph Farrugia would shoot Amabile Rica dead. But why? Was it a revenge attack, a turf war, a gangland hit, or a sadistic execution to send a message to the criminals of Soho that a new terror of Maltese London was in town and he was not to be trifled with? Sadly not. Their rift was a rather petty affair, and it all began in the place where it would end. In November 1945, 2.5 years before the murder, Philip Farrugia decided to treat his wife Olive to a lovely evening at the Maltese Club at No. 3 Carlisle Street. Sashaying in via the squeaky side door, the giggling couple sauntered down the dark alley that it shared with a pub, a cafe, a brothel, and a funeral parlour. Having passed the overflowing bins, Philip escorted his beloved down a rickety metal stairs and into two dimly lit rooms. Filled with a mishmash of threadbare chairs, wonky tables, and the stale odour of sweat, smoke and bum guffs. Where she would be spoiled by a choice of either tea or coffee, a game of billiards or rummy, and the inane waffle of several part-time cooks and pretend gangsters, who bitched and moaned about all manner of pathetic shit, like a gaggle of old ladies sat around a biscuit tin at their weekly sewing circle. That night, as a regular at the Maltese Club, Amabile Rika was there with his new floozy. As always, being drunk, brusque, and potty-mouthed, this nasty bastard began to abuse the girl whose name he hadn't even bothered to learn by slapping her and whacking her with a billiard cue. So doing the decent thing, Philip and Olive stepped in. Amabile pushed Olive, a lady half his size, to the floor, and squaring off against Philip, with his chest puffed out and acting like he was a Billy Big Bollocks, Amabile warned Philip,
"If your wife go to police, I kill you."
Obviously, by "I kill you," he probably meant that, having fumbled a loaded gun in his fat fingers, he'd then drop it and accidentally cause his death by negligence. But at that point, the spat between Amabile Rika and the Faruja brothers had begun. Over the next 2 years, Amabile repeatedly taunted the brothers. He chided Francis by saying,
"Don't speak to me no more. I break you three up, run you out of London."
And twice he taunted Joseph by cursing,
"I will kill you all. I will cut you all up into pieces and bits and throw you all away."
But he never did. Wisely, Philip stayed out of the way. But for various reasons, the two brothers could not. As they all frequented the same club, often worked in the same restaurant, and as if this wasn't weird enough, Francis lived in a top-floor flat at 66 Frith Street in Soho. And his flatmate was Amabile Rika. So scared was little Francis of his burly roommate, who had eyes like Satan's nostrils, fists like meat hooks, and it is said that he slept with a knuckle duster on his fist, a knife in his hand, and a loaded gun in his underpants, that by the end of May, even though he was still paying the rent, Francis was sleeping elsewhere. Francis was petrified. But just 3 weeks later, Amabile Rika would be dead. Tuesday the 15th of June 1948 began as a very ordinary day. The two Faruja brothers woke up in Cecily Courtney's flat at 17 St Luke's Road in Notting Hill, with Joseph in his girlfriend's bed, and being too afraid to head home, Francis kipping in their spare room. Francis hadn't slept a wink all night. As a small and slightly nervous man, he didn't like confrontations, he wasn't much of a fighter, and usually froze when faced with danger. Over a late tea of egg, chips and fried bread, Joseph reassured his baby brother and winked as he tapped his jacket pocket, which ominously bulged with a .32 caliber Walther pistol which he had purchased just 3 weeks earlier. At 6 p.m, Joseph and Francis caught the bus to Oxford Street, where they did their shopping, collected their payslips, chatted with chums, and then treated themselves to a nice cup of tea at the Tulip, a basement restaurant at 56 Greek Street, situated smack bang in the heart of Soho, but just one street from Amabile, Francis's flat, and the Maltese Club. In less than 3 hours, Joseph Faruja would shoot Amabile Rika to death. But he didn't know that. Joseph was here for billiards, not a bloodbath. But by 10 p.m, all that would change. sat inside the tulip, supping tea. Although Joseph and his gun had left the pots and balls, Francis felt safe, as around him were his pals. The mood was casual, fun, and calm, until the door swung open. Suddenly, a silence gripped the room, as mouths dried, throats gulped, and hearts stopped. But it was too late to leave, or even to flee, as being a bad dude, with 47 convictions for assault, attempted murder, and murder, including a brutal attack on a barrow boy, who some said was lucky to be alive. Everybody fell in fear of the terror of Maltese London. Looming ever closer, wincing at the foul smell from his sweaty brown suit, his yellowy crooked teeth, and his bad breath, owing to his passion for pickled eggs, Francis's petrified pals shuffled further away in their seats, as within an inch of Francis's ear, Amabile hissed, "I run you out of town. I kill you bad." Perhaps this was an empty threat, one he had reneged on many times before. Or maybe it wasn't. Francis was alone, afraid, and unlike his brother, he was unarmed. Spotting his moment, Francis fled the restaurant, and a few seconds later, he was safe. Except, as he reached Soho Square, he realized he hadn't paid for his cup of tea and returned to the tulip with an apology on his lips and a tuppence in his hand. Amabile saw him, got up, and stalked his tiny prey all the way to the Maltese Club at number 3 Carlisle Street. 30 minutes later, Amabile Rica, the terror of Maltese London, and one of Soho's most infamous and brutal gangsters, would be gunned down in a hail of bullets and blood. Sort of. Through the dark back alley, past the overflowing bins, and down the rickety metal staircase, Francis dashed into the safety of the Maltese Club. Inside sat the usual band of misfits and part-time kitchen staff, all sipping tea and acting tough, shielded from danger by a bluff reputation and a silly nickname. In the billiard room, Joseph played against the club's co-owner, Big George Mifsud. As watching from the side was Nicky the Malt Borg, Giovanni the Meat Portelli, George Fisheye Taluti, and a man who was only known as Cush, because his surname was Cushison. And in the card room, playing gin rummy, was Frankie Jerdin, who had a squint, Nicky the Butcher, who had a double thumb on his right hand, and John Borg, known as Hanzira. As being short, fat and pale, his nickname translated as the pig. They were joined in a game of cards by Francis, as out back in the kitchen, Harry Ardino was making the tea. As notorious gangsters go, these guys were at best slightly surly, and at worst, laughable. At 10:15 p.m, the heaving sweaty bulk of Amabile Rica limped down the stairs of the Maltese Club. To the left, in the card room, he saw no sign of Francis, whose weak bladder meant he had popped to the loo. So Amabile walked into the billiard room. Slumping his flabby backside on a threadbare chair, the fat oaf groaned and moaned, as having removed his shoe, a dirty bandage, and massaging his stinky foot, the Maltese terror whinged about his blisters like an old biddy with a dodgy hip. Unwittingly admitting that his foot wasn't injured in a bloody fight with a barrow boy, but that his shoes were rubbing a bit. But across the billiard table, seeing Joseph Ferrugia, suddenly Amabile's mood changed. Popping on his shoe and standing nose to nose with his rival, as he hovered his hand just inside his jacket. Amabile shot Joseph a filthy look and cursed,
"I kill you. I kill you both."
Only to then grin, laugh, and back away. For now, the threat was over, and the danger looked as if it had passed. But by the time that the laughing bully had limped back into the hallway, in the card room, he saw that Francis had returned. They traded glances, with Amabile stood by the stairs, glaring and grinning, taunting this tiny terrified man, whose playing cards violently shook in his terrified hand. As this infamous killer, feared across all of Soho, mouthed the words,
"I kill you, I kill you."
With his hand in his jacket, he lunged forward. Fired from a distance of just half an inch, the first shot ripped through Amabile's back, breaking his third rib and fragmenting into bits. As one piece pierced his heart, and the main chunk of lead sliced through his left lung. As he sunk to his knees, Joseph fired again. But his piss-poor aim scared the shit out of the card players, as a smoking-hot bullet riveted itself into the heart of the wooden table. Clutching his chest, Amabile cried,
"Kaduni! Kaduni!"
Which in Maltese means, "They've killed me." Being slumped like a sweaty lump at the foot of the stairs, his painful demise was marked by his wristwatch, which shattered at exactly 10:29 p.m. The moment this nasty bastard struggled to clamber up the stairs and out to the safety beyond, as his slipping feet swam in a pool of his own sticky blood. Dying and wailing, no one stopped to help him, no one came to his aid. Even though there was a telephone just above his head, no one called the police until 10 minutes later. Amabile Rica was rushed to Charing Cross Hospital, but by 10:55 p.m, he was declared dead. When the police arrived, the crime scene was strangely empty. There was a dying man, two bullets, an empty cartridge, and lots of blood. But no gun, no culprit, and not a single eyewitness. A few had stayed behind, but they all claimed to have been indisposed, distracted, or suffering from some kind of odd amnesia when the shooting took place. And as there was apparently no regulars in this club that evening, only strangers, the manager could only remember his customers by nickname. By the next morning, as Soho's Maltese community was small and all of the known felons who frequented that club weren't difficult to track down, every witness was identified, interrogated, and even though their memories were vague and many miraculously lost the ability to speak a single word of English, the only two people who were missing was Joseph and Francis. Joseph and Francis Ferrugia were tried at the Old Bailey on the 16th of July 1948. They both pleaded not guilty on the grounds of self-defense. But as the dead man was unarmed, 21-year-old Francis was charged as an accessory and sentenced to 6 months in prison, and 29-year-old Joseph was found guilty of murder. He was sentenced to 5 years, but served only 3. And that was the story of Amabile Rica. Supposedly, he was one of Soho's most dangerous and feared gangsters, who died from a badly aimed shot by a part-time cook, having bitched about his feet, made faces, and cursed some empty threats in a club which only sold tea. He sounds pathetic, but this need to have a reputation is common amongst frightened boys trying to play big in a man's world. So was this a myth created as a form of self-protection? Was it concocted by those who witnessed his death as a form of self-defense? Or was Amabile Rica really the terror of Maltese London. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. After the break, I'm going to eat a biscuit, slurp my tea, entertain you with a quiz, part of which I'll probably ruin, and I'll impart some more facts about this case in an exciting installment of Extra Mile. Before that, a big thank you to my new Patreon supporters, who are Dreaded Frankie and Estelle Sullivan. I thank you both. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
That is that. That's done. Done, 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 done. Long. Difficult to edit, but there we go. Oh, hello everyone. Murder Mile, Extra Mile time. Oh, doors open, windows open, get some air in. Oh, I can't find the latch to the window. Come on. Why is that window not opening? Hang on, there we go, window open, there we go. Bit of fresh air, cool, dear. Lots of sunlight streaming in. Oh, how is everyone? We all good? I'm going to pop my tea on, get my cake ready. You can do the same if you like. Tea, cake, all done. I'm going to shout it from here. We all know this bit anyway. It's Extra Mile time, isn't it? Extra Mile, extra bits. I have a cup of tea and a bit of cake. And I tell you some stuff that wasn't in the episode that's probably been edited out. Or stuff that I know definitely isn't in the episode. Because, you know, sometimes there's bits that you just can't put in. Or it's just extraneous information and you just think, nah, let's do it next time. So, tea bag in. Sugar in. Only one sugar, because this is... Sugar... Oh, drop my sugar. Bollocks. There we go. Coming back. Right.
Oh, there we go. Let's do a quick update on what's going on. Oh, I'm going to open a door.
I'm going to open the door and get some fresh air in. Oh, cool, that's better. Oh, open another window. I'm going to open this window as well. Look at me spoiling myself with all these windows open.
It's quite a sunny day and there's a lot of light streaming in, so, whoa, dear. Right, what's the update? Everything's as before here, still in the same place. Not really moving, got to stay here for another 2 weeks, which is fine. I think the easing of the lockdown has happened here, which is... I know the government is desperate for that because they're more concerned about the economy than people. But, you know, Britain has just passed the point where we have... What is it? Highest... Was it third highest death toll in the world? Highest in Europe, second highest in the world. and they're easing the lockdown rules. Not good. Things aren't going to go well. But there we go. Let's not get maudlin about this. It is what it is. Just to say, Murdmar Walk still isn't open yet. What I've made the decision to do is, because it's you're out on the street and you're meeting people, and if I do reopen it, it will be open on a limited basis, so it'll probably just be 10 people allowed, so we can keep the distance. Even if the government says, yeah, you can start doing tours again, I'm probably not going to do it. I'm going to open it when I feel it's safe. I don't want to be one of these people who rush into it and then, be responsible for a second wave of infections and things like that. I'd rather be safe about it. So it will open when it's safe to do so and when I feel it's safe to do so. But just to say, if you've already got tickets for I know some people have booked for the year ahead, or you've got vouchers, don't worry about that. That's all good. What I'm going to do is I'm going to extend those vouchers for as long as needed, really. As long as this thing goes on, I'll extend it. And, people have got in touch with me and said, can we extend it? It's like, yeah, not a problem. I add an extra year on. It doesn't make a difference. So that's not a problem. And if you want it refunded, I can do that. It may take a little while. Some people ask for refunds. I hadn't got any money in my account, so I had to go, I'm really sorry, I can't refund you right now because I haven't got any money. You have to wait. Normally I have money in my account to be able to do things like that, but I don't anymore. So, but there we go. That's what it is. Hope you enjoyed that episode. This was an episode I've been meaning to pull out the archives for bloody ages, but it's one of those ones I thought, oh, I bet it's going to be dull. I bet it's just going to be someone beating someone up. So because I didn't know enough about it, I kept putting it off, and then I pulled it out and I read it and I thought, this is the murder itself is pretty pathetic. There was enough patheticness about it that I kind of liked, whinging and bitching about their feet, and the fact that all the gangsters in there seem like, just like old ladies in a sewing circle. No offense to people in sewing circles, but it reminded me of I hate gangster books. I hate people glorifying gangsters. Most of the time gangsters are really, really dull, and it reminded me of a book I did read ages ago, which is really good. If you want a gangster book, this is an interesting one. It's called The Real Donnie Brasco by Joseph D. Pastone. Johnny Depp was in a film about it ages ago. It's about an FBI officer who goes into the mafia and actually rises through the ranks in mafia as a kind of a jeweler. But it's a real book, but it's fascinating because it's a big chunk of it is about how dull and boring the mafia life is. On TV, they glamorise it a lot, but really it isn't. It's a lot of sad, depressed people sitting around watching telly, doing nothing. It's very over-glamorised. They're all poor. They're all struggling. They lack brains. There's no masterminds there. And there's a lot of kind of instability in there as well. So it's a fascinating book. That's actually why the mafia hated him a lot more, was that instead of, even though he was inside the mafia, they were like, he's showing us for the idiots that we really are. And unfortunately, gangsters are that. They're not brains of the operation, but they love to brag. So this is what the episode I wanted to write. Just putting my water in. So I kind of alluded to this in this Alfredo Zamperelli episode, that people always go, oh, gangsters are all geniuses and all bad boys. But like, as I mentioned with the Tony Mello episode, episode 2, I put in that Tony Mello was cut up by Mad Frankie Fraser, because Mad Frankie Fraser is the one who kind of brags about it. But the more I look into it, there's currently 12 gangsters, I'm a gangster, who claim to have cut up Tony Mello. Yeah, there's three who claim that they murdered him, even though he was shot by his business partner. We know that. It's all proven. But that's the problem with gangsters is they will happily go in and take claim for everything and go, yeah, I did this. I'm a bad boy. I'm a gangster. But there's no proof for it at all. They're just bullshitters, which is what's it called? There's a podcast I was listening to about mafia. It's called Crime City or something. I can't remember what it's called. I got partway through it and I was enjoying it, but then I started to get pissed off because it was a lot of the gangsters in there are all like that. They're all the same. They all make all these claims all the time. But when you sit them down and pin them down with information, they're like, oh no, it's blah, blah, blah. They're just full of shit. So that's why I wanted to do this episode. I thought this would be a good way to kind of... And it was funny going through, like, their back history and finding out the truth about what they did. It was like, it's so pathetic. It really is. But that is how myths start. It's like, you know, the same with anyone. Like, even if you look into someone's past history, even if they're a success, everyone fudges the truth. Everyone takes a perspective. Everyone twists it slightly to make themselves either better or poorer or, do you know, whatever suits their story. Especially look at politicians. They all do it. We all do it when we pull out our CVs and resumes. We kind of edit things down to make it better or, you know, whatever. So... that's why I wanted to do this episode. I'm going to grab my tea. Tea with no proper milk today. No moo-moo boo-boo milk. Yeah. Just going to have regular old coffee, mate. Regular old coffee, mate. No cake today. I tried those biscuits last week, the Maryland cookies, the cookies and cream. Maryland cookies, what have you done? It's like, it's so bland. No texture to them, really dry. Even when you dunk them in a tea, they're not good. Really gone off Maryland cookies. Not proper cookies. Cookies should be a bit chewy. There's a great place, I hope they still survive, called Cream. On D'Arblay Street in Soho. It's a place where we used to stop when I used to tour. So we used to do tours, we used to stop there. They just opened up a couple of weeks before everything finished. And they're big, fat cookies, more like muffins, and they're big and gooey and juicy. And oh my God, they're good. That's proper cookie, not the crap that we're used to. Anyway, what have I got today? My little treat is Tesco's Finest. Ooh, Tesco's Finest. Triple chocolate shortbread. Ooh, yes. Big old chocolate chunks in there as well. So that's all good. That's all good. I look forward to that. Am I putting on weight? Yes. Right. Let's do the quiz. And then, because we've got a lot of information to get through, a lot of stuff I had to take out, especially at the end. Right. Quick slurp of tea. Oh, a cup of tea. Lovely. Right. Question number one. What type of gun was Amabile Rika shot with? That was your question number one. Question number two. What was the name of the restaurant Francis forgot to pay for his cup of tea? I think that was one of my favourite details. Francis the gangster forgetting to pay for his cup of tea and then going back and going in and apologising and pulling out a tuppence. Question number three. Just some of the, I'm sure that someone's listening to this story and they go, well, that's not true. But it's like, the more I was going through these details, I had to keep going back and rechecking everything. Because I was like, I'm surely someone is just yanking me chain on this one. But really, no, it was, they're not the bad boys they make out to be. Question three. What jobs did the Ferrugia brothers originally do in Malta? Question four. Amabile Rika was the terror of Maltese London. But what other nicknames was he known by? There were two of them. Question five. What time was Amabile Rika shot according to his watch? I've written the wrong time here. I'm just going to amend that. Question number six. When Amabile was shot, he cried, Gatuni, Gatuni. But what does that mean? Question seven. Name one of the five crimes that Joseph Ferrugia was charged with in Malta. If you like, you can name all five. Or you can name as many as you like, in fact. Question eight. Name the Ferrugia brothers' birth names. So their real names, of course, was Philip. Well, the names they used, the anglicised versions, were Philip, Francis and Joseph. But what were their real names? Question nine. One of the witnesses to the murder was John Borg. He was short, fat and pale. And he had the nickname of Hanzira. But what does Hanzira mean? What was his nickname? Question ten. Amabile Rika died in which hospital? Interestingly, it's a hospital that Freddie Mills died in as well. No longer there, just off the Strand, but it is still there. Right, let's dive into some details. There's quite a few details that I didn't go into because I do you know, when you're into the story and you've done the murder, the last thing you need is like more extraneous details. So I pulled stuff out. So the real owner of the club was Emmanuel Vassallo. He's part of the Vassallo gang, the Maltese collective. You've got the Messina brothers and the Vassallo gang, rival gangs. He owned this club. But he always pretended that he never owned it. So he had George Misford. Bloody stupid name, as the co-owner of it. Obviously, in there we've got Nicholas Borg, known as Nicky, not related to John Borg. There's a lot of people who don't seem to be related to people. Nicola Ferrugia, no relation to the Ferrugia brothers. He was a light fitter by trade, but known as Nicky the Butcher. Why, we don't know. And yes, he had a double thumb on his right hand. John Borg was there. He was a delivery driver and grocer. Called Hanzira. I'm not going to explain why because that's in the thing next. Let's skip through these. George Misford. Let's go straight to the murder. See, there's various versions of the murder. Because when the police collared everyone was like, oh, I never saw it. And then people started talking, but then there were all kind of weird versions of it. So George Misford. Stupid. Apologies if your name is Misford. He said that Ambal arrived at 10:15. He sat in the billiard room and complained that one of his feet were hurting. He took off his shoe, massaged it, put it back on. He said he heard, but he didn't see, which is amazing because this club's really small. He heard two shots from the other room. He dashed into the card room and heard Ambal say, "Ooh, he's killing me." Which I guess is what you do when you've been shot. He said Amabar Rico was doubled up, trying to walk towards him. George ran up the staircase. George Misford, so the co-owner of the club, says he saw a man run towards Soho Square. I didn't know who he was. Yeah. In a small club at the back, on a back street, where everyone knows each other and they're all Maltese, and he said he didn't know anyone. What absolute bullshit. He was the one who eventually did call the police, but not until about 10 minutes later. George always said the club was quiet, neat, orderly. They don't have an alcohol license, which is why they only drink tea and coffee. They play billiards and cards, but they can't. They don't have a gambling license, so they just play for matches. Yeah, whatever. Two shots were heard in the club. Rika was found doubled up in the doorway just at the bottom of the stairs. He was fired. Shot was fired from about half an inch away. Francis's statement. Francis Ferrugia said that Amabar glared at him. He had his hand in his pocket and he walked towards him. He said that Amabar Rika said when he was shot, "Ooh, my head." Yeah. Obviously, after this point, so there was a bit of a panic after that. Witnesses started fleeing. Everyone fled, including Joseph and Francis. Joseph said to his brother, "You see what happened to me? I lose my temper." That's what he said to him. But Joseph actually said that he said, "I thought he had a gun, as in Amabar Rika, so I didn't give him a chance. I got the gun out of my pocket and shot him. He turned round and was just passing me out of the billiard room when I shot him." What is going on outside? That's really noisy. He tried to run into the card room. He bent down again. I fired again. Although it's weird, everyone's statement kind of isn't really backed up by the police evidence. The police evidence were like, okay, everyone is lying here. Everyone is just telling their own version. All the witnesses flee. The two brothers ran out, headed towards Oxford Street. Francis was thrown the gun by Joseph, and they hid it in the bushes in Soho Square. I didn't put this in the story because we kind of got to the story by the end of that point. 10:29, so basically 10 minutes after the murder, the police received a message. That was by John Mifsud, who called them, but he left it for about 10 minutes. PCs Leslie Cummings and Arthur Pearson of V Division went to the basement. Amabile was lying at the bottom of the stairs, still alive, head on the bottom step, knees drawn up, moaning and holding his stomach, bloodstains on the front of his shirt and a trail of bloodstains to and from the card room. Police found a bullet casing in the card room floor. The door was open. D.S. Shepherd arrived at 11 p.m. What else we got? When the police spoke to the manager, George Misford, he said he was unable to recall how the dying man received his wounds. Amabile was removed by ambulance. There was no weapon found in the club because they had dumped it in Soho Square. One empty cartridge on the floor. This is something I didn't put in the story, but Lewis was in there, who was actually Amabile Rika's brother, was in there as well, followed him to Charing Cross Hospital and identified the body when he was dead. There was a bullet hole in the top of the card table with a direct line leading to the lino below and a floorboard, proving that everyone was lying, and they recovered a spent bullet in the floorboard. So actually, they're unsure, but it's more than likely that Amabile Rika was probably leaning over the table at the time that he was shot. As mentioned before, he was unarmed, he didn't have a knife, he didn't have a gun, he didn't have a knuckle duster. So all these stories about him being, he's unarmed, he's gangster, he's deadly, he hadn't got any of that at all. What he was reaching for inside his jacket, we don't know, given the fact that he was a bullshit artist and he liked to go, "I kill you, I kill you." Given the fact that he never did that and he always reneged on those kind of things, it was just empty threats. Like a child reaching into his pocket pretending he's got a gun. Yeah. All those bad boys who walk around town with their Terry Towling tracksuits on, Joe, trying to make out that they're bad boys. And they're not. They're waiting for their mummy to make them pizza and chips. Amabile was taken to Charing Cross Hospital. He arrived at 10:50 p.m. Examined by Dr. Daniel Stone. He was unconscious, but he was dead within 5 minutes. He was undressed to aid his treatment. The doctor noticed a bullet between his body and his shirt. A small circular wound to the left shoulder, and that his watch had stopped at 10:29 p.m. with the glass smashed. His clothes were extensively bloodstained. What else we got? Unfortunately, there's no crime scene photos with this one. I don't know why. They're just not there, so which was a shame because they would have been quite interesting, even just to see what the room looked like. I would have liked to see that, but sometimes you get there and you go, oh, no crime scene photos. The investigation was headed up by D.I. Watson Payton. As mentioned, you know, everyone, they managed to track down everyone who was involved because it's not difficult. They're in Soho, small Maltese community. Everyone knows each other. People talk. No one particularly liked Amabile Rika. So, you know, if it was someone people that he liked, the community would have been very silent about it. There's another case that I've researched and I haven't put out as a story, which is the same. It's so difficult to prove because the community just won't talk. I think it's a Turkish community, and no one will talk, so it makes it for a very difficult story to tell. But with this one, I guess if Amabile would have been a nice person, people would have come out and helped the police. But because he was a nasty piece of shit, everyone was like, "Fuck him." No one could care, really. But, you know, the police knew who all these people were. They went around, they rounded up the usual suspects, they questioned them, probably threatened them with deportation as well, because, you know, many probably weren't in the country legally. And, you know, people started talking and they were like, "Oh, okay, so, you know, Hanzira was there and Borg was there." And, you know, they started mentioning names and they started drawing up a picture and made it very easy. And then they were like, "Oh, okay, so Joseph and Francis weren't there. Well, there we go." A gun was proved to be... Oh, I almost gave that away because that's a question, isn't it? The gun had... It was an automatic. It had one cartridge in the barrel. Two were spent that we already know of. And there was also a bullet was stuck in the breech, which means that it had jammed. So obviously Joseph fired two shots. One shot hit Rika in the back. The other one hit the table, which I think must have been a mistake because his brother was sitting there, for God's sake. So clearly he was probably trying to shoot off a couple of shots and then one jammed. So what else we got? Amabar Rika's blood sample was at high levels of alcohol, the equivalent to 5 large whiskies. What else we got? Oh, yeah, the escape. I didn't do the escape. So they took this out of the story because I just thought, you know, the murders happen. Why do we need to know the escape unless it's really important? So Joseph's girlfriend was Cecily Courtney of 14 St. Luke's Road in Notting Hill. She arrived back home at 11:30 p.m. and found them both in the flat. This tallies with their timings. Joseph and Francis had a long conversation in Maltese. She doesn't speak Maltese. Joseph said, I'm going to go to Southampton. He had a house in Southampton and he lived there for a while because he was actually in the Navy for a bit. Joseph slept with Cecily and Francis again in the spare room. In the morning, Cecily asked what was wrong. And Joseph said, I have shot Rika in the club in Carlisle Street. They knew they needed to hide. Francis couldn't go back to his flat because that's in the middle of Soho, although you'd think. They went to their brother's. So they need to escape. They left their flat at 8:30 a.m. the next day. They were reading the newspapers. They saw that it was a newspaper as well. They'd already hidden the gun in Soho Square. Where is this bit? So, finding Francis. Here's my section. By the morning, one witness had said that the Ferrugia brothers were ill-disposed towards the murdered man. Francis was traced to his address on Frith Street. Yes, he returned back to his flat on Frith Street. The police, by the next morning, were already out sitting outside his flat and running a surveillance on there. They saw him come back into his flat and they detained him. Initially, he denied all knowledge of the incident, but then he was like quite clear about it. He was like, yep, this is what happened. Originally in the story, with the original story to do with Philip and Olive, when the spat happens between the Ferrugia brothers and Amabile, there is a bit of a beef with them back, apparently, in Malta, where Amabile slapped Philip Ferrugia, the older brother, but we really don't have any details on that and can't prove it. And the fight that happened originally in the Carlisle Club, this was the one about 2.5 years earlier, when Amabar Rika was beating up his girlfriend / floozy, we're not too sure, and Olive stepped in. It's said that she was pushed to the floor, but in other references it said she was pushed down a flight of stairs. But given the fact that she didn't report this to the police, and no one did, there's no real evidence for that at all. So I've kind of put it as she was pushed to the floor, but they're saying she was pushed down a flight of stairs. But we don't know. It's also said that Amabar was trying to force the three brothers out of London, but we don't know why. It's weird. Why would another gangster say, force you out of London? Unless they were involved in something which we don't really know about. So could be. There could be some kind of prostitution angle there, because don't forget their brother was charged with running a brothel and Joseph was charged with living off of moral earnings. So who knows? What else we got? Let's have a look. Francis was questioned. He later gave a full statement implicating his own brother Joseph as the shooter. And that he had hidden the gun in Soho Square. He directed the police to it, and it was found lying in the long grass. Not too sure where. Francis originally just after the shooting, took Joseph to Paddington Station and he got on a train to Cardiff. At that time, there was a large Maltese community in Cardiff. He went to stay in Barry Island, because he had loads of friends there, and asked them to look after his wife and kids as he was worried about their safety. What happened? He read about all the murder in the papers. He found out that his brother had kind of been picked up by the police, and he was like, shit, I'm in trouble now. So what he did was he got back on the train. The police were already trying to track him down. They went around all of the Maltese cafes in the area trying to find him, but they managed to find his girlfriend. They questioned his girlfriend. He found out about that and he was like, sod this. He surrendered himself at West End Central Police Station. And his first comments were, my brother did not shoot Rika, I did. He was cautioned and he said, Rika has been after us for a long time. We were all frightened of him, so I didn't give him a chance. I knew he had a gun. He didn't have a gun. What else we got? We don't need to know about that. They were charged. That's all good. When questioned, Joseph said, as Rika came towards me, someone pushed a gun in my hand and everything went blank. I can't remember if I shot him, but I heard a shot. You know what it's like when someone pushes a gun into your hand and you can't remember holding the gun and you can't remember shooting it, but you definitely remember hearing it. Fortunately, this whole case is just full of things like that. I had a whole section to do with all the what everyone said and what everyone saw, and it was just so confusing. Everyone was like, I either weren't there or I didn't see it, or it was, or what they did. Do you know, they all say that different people saw different things. To be honest, the police did a really good job on that. It wasn't difficult for them to solve, to be honest. Originally, there was a coroner's inquest on the 22nd of June, just a few days later. The body was identified by Lewis, the brother of Amabile. Evidence was given by a doctor and a pathologist, and it was adjourned till the 27th of July. Trial, as mentioned. I was looking at stuff then. I think that's everything I wanted to say. Yeah, that's good. Whew, out of breath. I can do with my cup of tea now. Right, let's answer those questions and then we won't forget. I'm going to add something into a link on here. So it's something I'm starting to do people on Patreon. So I've started doing extra things on there. A new one I rolled out recently was someone was asking a question about how I create Murder Mile, because it's not just me saying words and then just putting a bit of music underneath. It's like it takes 4 days to really edit and make it all clean, and it's a long time. So I put in a little video that I'll put in a link online, and it was in the last week's episode, how I created the sound of the mobile phone footage that you were hearing in the background, how long that takes, that's this week's one. Giving that one away. It was about kind of street sounds and stuff like that. So I've put that in. So if you want to see that video and see how long it takes to do, this is like a one minute section of Murder Mile. How long it takes just to do that. So it does take a long time. Before we do the answers to the questions, the thing I mentioned in Murder Mile that I haven't mentioned is that I did a live read. Well, I say I did a live reading. At the time of this, I haven't done the live reading yet. That's this Sunday. So I don't know whether it went well. I don't know whether it happened. But it was something else. I just wanted to make things a little bit different for everyone and make it more exciting. And, you know, because the people who do pay for Patreon, you know, their money really buys all the equipment and stuff like that. So I want to make it worth their while. I know people go, oh, you're always giving all this good stuff to people on Patreon. It's like, yeah, but they paying for, like, you know, web hosting and, you know, my equipment and stuff like that. So, you know, I always feel that they need to get their money's worth. So I've added in a new thing, which is, it won't be a regular thing, but it's kind of, it's a live reading. So I'll be doing a live reading of this. By the time you hear this, it's already happened. Of this episode. And it's just me in front of a webcam. You can tune in. You can get it through Patreon. It was open to everyone last week, but the ones I do, they won't be weekly, but the ones after that, if it goes well, will be through Patreon only. And it's just a bit of fun, do you know? Even before the episode comes out, you can hear the episode before it's even live. So just something different to give people who very kindly keep Murder Mile alive by subscribing to Patreon. It's just another extra thing that I'm adding in there. So you can subscribe to Patreon. It literally $3 a month is the minimum on there. And to be honest, you get a lot of good stuff with that. You get a thank you card from me with badges and goodies in it, and you get each week is a weekly script with the original script is in there, and you get all of the videos in there that I shoot for all this. You get extra. I sometimes post things online, like photos and stuff, but I save all of the crime scene photos, all the big stuff. I post it in Patreon, so they get all the good stuff as well. And I'm doing all the behind the scenes photos or videos, which will go on there as well, and the live readings as well. So and if higher up the ranks, you get early access to all the episodes as well, no adverts. And higher up as well, you get an exclusive Murder Mile mug of goodies. Oh, exciting. So that's that bit done. Whew, I'm out of breath already. Right, tiring myself. Right, let's do the answers to these questions. Whew, a cup of tea. Oh, it's nice to be silent for a bit. I've been talking for 2 hours, 3 hours straight. Whew, right. Talking to myself. Right, question one. What type of gun was Amabile Rika shot with? He was shot with a 32 caliber Walther. So it's a German-made World War II gun. Obviously around the time of World War II, even though we didn't have a lot of guns at the start of World War II, there was a big influx of... If you listen to episode 13, I discuss it in there. Because we don't have a gun culture here... basically, the British government said, "Hey, America, do you have any spare guns?" And they were like, "Yeah, sure, we can loan you, we can give you a couple of, like 100,000 or something like that." So we had loads of variety, not new guns, but obviously it was spare ones that people there had spares, and they were like, "Yeah, that's fine, you can have that rifle if you like want," and all that. So we had an influx of, I think it was near 50,000 guns. Flooded into the country, were used for the war, and when the war was over, obviously there's an excess of guns, so they kind of wandered into the black market. Many of them were scrapped, big chunks of them were dumped in the North Sea, but unfortunately many of the guns are still out there today. So a lot of the guns that people are shot with are actually still World War II guns, but they're just, you know, people have been keeping them in good condition. Whew, that was a bit of a waffly answer. The answer was a 32 caliber Walther. There we go. Question two. What was the name of the restaurant that Francis forgot to pay for his cup of tea in? It was, of course, the Tulip, which is on Greek Street. I've put a photo of that on Patreon. Question three. What jobs did the Ferrugia brothers originally do in Malta? Philip was becoming a cook. Joseph worked as a stevedore, which meant he was unloading cargo in the dock. And Joseph was a labourer in Valletta Harbour. Question four. Whew, my energy has just dropped. Amabile Rika was the terror of Maltese London, but what other nicknames was he known by? These were briefly mentioned, but his nicknames were the Maltese Barber and Ricky the Malt. Question five. What time was Amabile shot? According to his watch, it was 10:29. When Amabile was shot, he cried, "Kadoni, Kadoni!" But what does that mean? In Maltese, apparently, it means, "They've killed me." This is according to the witnesses there. But then again, I don't speak Maltese, so how would I know that? Question 7. Name one of the 5 crimes that Joseph Arruja was charged with in Malta. You can name as many as you like, to be honest. They were, he had 2 convictions for brawling, i.e. fighting, 1 for disturbing the peace, 1 for using immoral words in public, 1 for throwing stones, and 1 for firing a gun near, but not at, his dad. What bad boy. Question 8. Name the Ferrugias' birth names. Philip was Philip. Francis was Francisco. And Joseph was Giuseppe. Question 9. One of the witnesses to the murder was John Borg. He was short, fat and pale. But his nickname of Hanzira means what? Apparently, according to those witnesses, it means the pig. Question 10. Amabile Rica died in which hospital? The answer is Charing Cross. And it's not the big Charing Cross hospital that's there at the moment. Oh, that's the modern one. This is the it's right next to episode 3, which is the baby batterer of Bedford Bury. Just off the Strand, there's the current Charing Cross police station, and that is the old Charing Cross hospital. So that's, whenever I mention Charing Cross, that's where they're taken to. So there, that's that done. Good, that was that episode. Right. Now 3 days to get this edited. Ugh. Although it's been 4 days at the moment, so let's see how it goes. Hope you all enjoyed that. I thought that was an interesting episode. I'm trying to balance it out. We had a bit of a kind of a political one last week. We've had some... I try and mix them up every week. So we've got investigation ones. Next week is going to be quite a sad one, if it's the one I think it is. I haven't checked. They're all different. That's what I try and do, is make sure they're all as different as possible, so you don't get bored and you don't think, oh, we've heard this story before. So there's new ones, there's old ones, there's emotional ones, there's kind of, yeah, all different. So I was looking forward to this one. I thought when I did the research for this, I wrote a note to myself and I was like, let's have fun with this one. So that's this one done. Hope you enjoyed that episode. I'm off to get this edited. Have yourself a good week. Stay safe, be good, drink tea and cake. Best wishes. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.